This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Antoine Roy. Mr. Roy is in New Boston, New Hampshire, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas. Today is January 8, 2003, at 9:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:45 a.m. Central Standard Time. Mr. Roy, let's start with some biographical information on yourself. Could you tell me where you were born and when you were born, and a little bit about your childhood?
Yes, I was born in Gardner, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. In 1948, my parents were divorced when I was about age four, mm-hmm. And I went to live with my grandmother for several years while my mother was searching for another husband, or especially a father for her children. I was living in the small village of Baldwinville, and there weren't too many available men around, so my mother moved to the nearest large city and worked, mm-hmm. where she could try and meet people, but she always came home faithfully every weekend. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were the most important thing to her.
Right.
At about age 10, she was working outside of Fort Devens, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and she met a man, First Sergeant Leo C. Henson's, mm-hmm. and they fell in love. We met him, and my sister and I, mm-hmm. and we and the whole family fell right in love with him immediately. Mm. He's an excellent human being. They ended up getting married, and we left my grandmother to go live with them. And probably a year or so afterwards, he was transferred to Ankara, Turkey, mm-hmm. and we lived there for 3 years. He was an army attaché. The embassy.
Okay.
And those were excellent years for me. The first time I was introduced to another culture, in this case an Islamic culture.
Right. And you were 10 years old?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was 10 years old, 11 years old, I guess, when I went over.
Okay.
At that same time, my father, after the divorce, had rejoined the service. He had been an artilleryman during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. He rejoined the service. And he was ended up working up to a first sergeant in artillery and then going over to weather forecasting, which is related to artillery. Mm-hmm. And he ended up as an army weather forecaster.
Okay.
Lived in Turkey for 3 years with my stepfather and my mother. Mm-hmm. And then we came back to Fort Devens, Massachusetts for a couple of years. And then my stepfather got orders for Ethiopia. Which was later canceled, and instead received orders for a little post outside of Nuremberg, Germany.
Okay.
At that time, I decided to go live with my real father, whom I hadn't lived with since I was four. Mm-hmm. He was stationed at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. So I went to live with him for a year while my mother, my stepfather, my sister, and my new half-sister went to Germany. I was with my father in Fort Huachuca for several months, and he got his orders cut to go to Fort Greeley, Alaska. Mm-hmm. So I went up to Fort Greeley, Alaska, spent about a year there, and then when the year was over, I flew over to Germany to rejoin my mother, stepfather, and my two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for about a year and a half when I graduated from high school. My grades at the time weren't very good, primarily because I was involved in puberty more
mm-hmm.
than learning.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I wouldn't be accepted to a college. I also knew that, you know, I'd grown up in a military atmosphere for the last few years. Like I said, both father and stepfather were first sergeants at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I am named after an uncle on my father's side who is missing in action, declared killed in action during the Second World War. He was a tail gunner in a B-25, and he was shot down mm-hmm. over northern Germany.
Okay.
So I was named Antoine Roy after him.
Okay.
And putting all that together and seeing that there was a war going on, and to an 18-year-old, you believe the things that, you know, war builds men, war matures you, you prove yourself. It was time for me to go down and sign up for the draft, and I happened to go past a recruiting office on the way. Mm-hmm. I went down, signed up for the draft, came back, and there was a table with a whole bunch of pamphlets out in front of the recruiting office, and I just started casually looking through them and saw a pamphlet on infantry and saw a pamphlet on paratroops and started thinking that, well, you know, I really don't have any future right now, and actually I'm going to get drafted pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go off to war to prove all those things that an 18-year-old sometimes wants to prove to themselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At the time, there wasn't really very much negative feelings about the war either.
Right. What year was this?
Right. Yeah, this was 1966, okay. About May.
Okay.
I went into the recruiting office, talked to the recruiter, and volunteered for a 3-year hitch. On the conditions that I be trained as a parachute infantryman, mm-hmm. and that they send me to Vietnam, which they were more than willing to guarantee.
I'm sure. I want to come back to some of your experiences in your childhood, but could you, while we're on this subject, why did you want to go to Vietnam? Was it because of what you just said as far as going to war builds men, that kind of thing that you
heard? Yeah, well, like I said, my father and my stepfather were both military men. I was mm-hmm. named after a military uncle killed mm-hmm. in action.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all always part of it. I'd grown up in a military atmosphere. And before I enlisted, you know, a lot of my friends' fathers, who were military men, were getting orders for Vietnam and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And then factor in the fact that, you know, a lot of 18-year-old males like to, you know, think this proves or develops manhood and maturity and things like that. Mm-hmm. So put it all together. And with the fact that I knew that I'd get drafted because of my grades,
right?
I just decided to make the move. And the idea of parachute infantry really appealed to my young male ego.
Right.
And I knew that I wanted to prove it in combat, so I had them put down the guarantee me send me to Vietnam.
Okay.
And that's how it came about.
Okay. Tell me about your experience in Turkey. You were 10, 11 years old when you went over there. What was that like for you?
It was fascinating. They were some of the better years of my life. I fit right into the culture, learned to accept it very easily. The American community, as all foreign communities tend to stick together, but we did interact an awful lot with local Turks.
Mm-hmm.
We rented an apartment from a Turkish landlord.
Mm-hmm.
I had a few Turkish friends. They were very good years to me. I had always had an interest in history and the ancient history in that area. I mean, the place is lousy with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every little village has a mound right next to it. And that mound is that village going back as far as, you know, 8,000, 9,000 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
There were old ancient forts, Roman, Hittite, Greek, Phrygian, Persian, you name it, all over the place. I started collecting ancient coins, which were extremely cheap
mm-hmm.
and were, again, everywhere. So I developed a real keen sense of history,
mm-hmm.
ancient history, especially then. Like I said, I had a very good time. I really enjoyed it.
Did you learn the language?
I knew enough to get around and to roughly understand what people were saying,
mm-hmm.
but I couldn't read it, I couldn't write it, and I wasn't fluent.
Okay.
But I knew enough at that age to be able to get around, because I used to go out on my own,
mm-hmm.
much to my mother's chagrin. Down looking for artifacts and going out to ancient mounds and the mm-hmm. like with other friends who were interested in archaeology.
Right.
It was fascinating. I was interested in I got interested in the history of Turkey itself.
Mm-hmm.
My first experience with politics was there were two revolutions while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Those were interesting to watch. Islam itself, I didn't get real deep into. I observed, you know, all Muslims doing prayers 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
The mullahs calling from the minarets and the like and mosques. I took a trip with a friend and his family to Istanbul, the old Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
Went into some of the large mosques that were originally Christian churches, some of the famous museums and the like there,
mm-hmm.
on the Ottoman Empire and everything. Went down to Gordian, where King Midas was supposed to reign and where Alexander cut the Gordian knot. And,
mm-hmm.
Did quite a bit of traveling around there, as much as I could at that age.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents, your mother and stepfather, did they encourage you to explore and to read and to do all this? Was this something that you had inside yourself that you really...
This is something I had inside myself. My mother used to get very upset when I would go down into the city. The antique shops in Turkey, they have antiques going back, like you said, you know, 7,000-8,000 years,
mm-hmm.
and covering all kinds of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to go down buying coins, which back then, I mean, you could get some nice Roman coins for $1 apiece.
Wow.
But she used to be a little upset sometimes and worry about me, but she generally, unless it was real extreme, let me go.
Mm-hmm.
My stepfather, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
My stepfather turned out to be an excellent surrogate father.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually the man who raised me, who gave me a lot of my values and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me as much freedom as he considered prudent.
It seems like the divorce of your birth parents did not really adversely affect you in your youth, so far is what I'm understanding.
That question I'd like to avoid.
Okay. So after Turkey, you're there for 3 years, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you come back to Fort Dennis.
Fort Devens,
excuse me, for a couple of years. And you're getting into junior high and high school at this point. What do you remember about these years when you come back to the United States from being in a foreign country at a young age? Was it difficult for you to transition back into this culture?
No, because I went to the high school outside of Fort Devens, which was the town of Ayer, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And Ayer, Massachusetts took all the military dependents as well as the local children.
Mm-hmm.
So about half of the kids there were military dependents, and they too had all traveled.
Okay.
So, I mean, there was a lot in common.
Right.
And the kids that were from the local area were very aware of all of this,
mm-hmm.
and some of their friends were friends with kids from Fort Devens and the like.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that wasn't a very hard transition at all.
Okay. And from there you go to live with your father in Arizona and then up to Alaska. What do you remember about that time in Arizona and Alaska?
I had Fort Huachuca, which is about 20 miles north of the Mexican border. I had an excellent time down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a desert culture. It was in the Sonoran Desert.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough for my father to make a connection so that I worked on an archaeological site at age 16 that the military had allowed on the military post at the front of one of the canyons, which fit, you know, fantastically into my interests.
Mm-hmm.
I also got into, you know, some old Western military culture. There are old Indian forts all over the West. I mean, just thousands of them.
Right.
And I got interested in those. Got exposed to some Mexican culture, being that close to Mexico itself. In fact, went into Mexico several times.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting orders to go to Alaska suddenly was a complete change.
Yes.
And we drove all the way to Alaska.
Wow.
My father had a camper on the back of a pickup truck, and he and my stepmother drove in the truck, and I laid up in the bed up over the cab, and that's pretty much the way I drove up to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped at national parks and sites on the way, up through Canada onto the Alcan Highway, and then up into the center of Alaska at Fort Greeley,
mm-hmm.
which was the military testing grounds for anything the military has. It has to be tested in cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that particular area around Fort Greeley happens to be one of the coldest areas in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And my real father, being an Army weather forecaster, I always knew what the weather developments were.
Right.
coldest I've been in is about 72 below.
Wow.
But then it would go into cycles. It would go 20 below for a week or so, then it'd go 40 below roughly for a week, and then roughly 60 below, mm-hmm. and then roughly begin the cycle all over again.
Mm-hmm.
We had snow, but it's generally too cold for too much snow
mm-hmm.
When you get into that environment. I got into hunting. I got into trapping. Did a lot of walking. We were at the edge of the tree line, a little bit further north and west. You get into tundra.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time in the woods, visited Fairbanks, different places around there. Enjoyed that because the physics were so completely different being that far north. I mean, during the summer, it's 23 hours. Midsummer, it's 23 hours of daylight.
Mm-hmm.
Midwinter, it's 23 hours of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Things like the northern lights. And it was fascinating. It was very, very interesting. So then after the year was up, as per the agreement, I flew to Germany, which flew up over the pole,
mm-hmm.
and joined my parents. My stepfather and my mother and sisters
mm-hmm.
at an American military post outside a little village called Herzogenaurach,
mm-hmm.
which is about 20 miles, southeast of Nuremberg,
mm-hmm.
An old medieval village. The post itself was an old Nazi training airfield that was hidden inside a little copse of woods. In fact, was never discovered until General Patton had overrun it by more than 20 miles.
Hmm.
And the buildings were all, with the old German military buildings, there were still sites for any aircraft guns.
Hmm.
Some of the window clasps still had the spread eagle on it.
Mm-hmm.
Our commissary PX was the old Gestapo headquarters in Nuremberg.
Wow.
And people were not allowed down into the basements. There were terrible things, of course, that happened down there.
Mm-hmm.
We played our football game. I don't know if you've ever seen Hitler and his famous Nuremberg speech.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we played our school football games inside that stadium.
Oh, my gosh.
And I used to the stadium is huge, and
yes.
I used to stop and think and look at the area where Hitler was standing.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you still see that spread eagle on a lot of the buildings, but the swastika had been chiseled out.
Mm-hmm.
We saw what had been what was going to be his world headquarters. There were lots of signs of the war still there.
Right.
Still a lot of war damage and the like. I worked in the post snack bar, which had a German manager and some German employees. I heard an awful lot about the war from them.
Were they willing to talk to you about that? Were you asking them
questions? Most of them, yes.
Mm-hmm.
What I did notice is that none of them were ever Nazis or believed in Hitler.
Okay.
Found that a little hard to believe, but found it understandable at the
mm-hmm.
same time.
Mm-hmm.
Germans are very friendly. Most of the Germans around remembered that after the war, instead of treating them viciously, that we brought them into democracy and allowed them to prosper again.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I never encountered any hard feelings about the German people, and the Americans generally got along quite well.
Mm-hmm.
I learned German pretty well, which mostly I've forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I could get around quite easily.
How difficult was it for you during these very formative years, junior high and high school, moving around a lot? Were you able to adapt to the different places you went? Sounds like you had an ability to do this.
Well, didn't have any choice. My sister was a little bit more adaptable than me.
Mm-hmm.
She went out and made friends very quickly and then kind of dragged me out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would make friends, but it would take me a little longer. But she was far more outgoing than I was.
Okay.
but always ended up with a close wide circle of friends.
Okay.
And again, everywhere we went, I mean, all the other kids were going through the same thing.
Right.
So you were able to identify with the group around you generally.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't feel like you were that different.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about your discussions or what kind of influence your father and your stepfather had upon your military career? You said your father had served in World War II. You were named for an uncle who served in World War II who was shot down. Your stepfather, did he serve in World War II as well?
No, he enlisted after the war, and he was on his way to Korea during the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And when the ship was two-thirds of the way there, the war ended.
Huh, okay.
So he was in Army Electronic Intelligence.
Okay.
And whereas, like I said, like my real father had been artillery originally and was now an Army weather forecaster.
Mm-hmm.
They really said very little about Vietnam. Very little at all. Of course, I only saw my real father once every few years.
Right.
Because we'd be stationed one place, he'd be stationed someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
But really very little was said. I first started noticing the war, I guess, when I was in Alaska. I remember reading the paper about the big battles, the first big battles in Vietnam in the Atrang Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And reading about the heavy combat. But not getting overly interested. Again, puberty was the main thing I was going through.
Right.
And I never knew that I myself would go into the Atrang one day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just little minor things that I noticed. I didn't follow it real closely at all.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were over at somebody else's house playing cards, and I was in the living room watching TV, and it came over, you know, the TV that we had initiated some airstrikes on Vietnam as a result of the Tonkin incident.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, gee, as soldiers, I guess they might want to know this. So I walked out and I said, the TV just said we're at war with North Vietnam. We just attacked them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite surprised to find that it just didn't register very much at all. They kind of laughed it off and went back playing cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of confused because I figured, boy, if it affects anybody, it should affect them.
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing that it would affect me much more. And again, I never really thought about it until it was time for me to go down and sign up for the draft.
Mm-hmm.
On my 18th birthday.
Okay.
And I just happened to notice the pamphlets and mm-hmm. started thinking about everything in my immediate future.
Mm-hmm.
So I signed up for what's known as a delayed entry.
Mm-hmm.
My birthday was in May, so I signed up to go in September.
Okay.
That would give me the summer off with my friends.
Right.
So I went in September. I was in Germany still at the time. My
right.
parents were there. And the Army flew me back to Fort Dix, New Jersey, where I went through basic training.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, during basic training, my stepfather, mother, and sisters, their tour ended in Germany, and they came back again to Fort Devens,
mm-hmm.
but they stopped at Fort Dix to visit me in basic training,
okay.
Which was a little embarrassing and made life a little bit more difficult when all the DIs found out that I was an Army brat because all of a sudden more was expected of me.
Right. Course.
So I ended up making squad leader in basic training.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us in basic training were going to different professions after basic. Basic was just basic training. I knew where I was going.
Right.
I adapted to the military very easily. I already had a good idea, you know, what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't the overly rebellious type of person. I did get annoyed with them now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But I fit in quite well. I have to tell you the truth, I enjoyed all of my training.
Really? What do you remember most about your basic training?
I had a DI, the platoon DI. He was a short black man,
mm-hmm.
had a degree in sociology, and was extremely intelligent and a heck of a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a draftee. He was only in for 2 years. But he was the kind of person that, even though he was very short, any one of us would have followed him anywhere. We had tremendous respect for him. I had tremendous respect. I mean, I really looked up to this person.
Mm-hmm.
And during the war, I'd often thought, gee, I mean, yeah, it's bad in the war, but he would have made an excellent sergeant
mm-hmm.
in a combat unit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because he really inspired people. He was very fair, but firm. He knew how to work with people, and that had a great effect on me.
Mm-hmm. What was the most challenging aspect of your basic training? If there was one.
Once in a while, well, you go through harassment
mm-hmm.
in basic training, and I didn't realize why at first. Afterwards, thinking about it, I realized why. And the reason why is because you're taking all these different people who don't know each other from all different walks of life, different parts of the country, and they have to be melded into a unit.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start harassing individuals or the whole group, and generally the whole group, at first you start thinking about, they're harassing me.
Mm-hmm.
They're giving me a hard time, making me do these ridiculous things for no good reason. But very quickly, since everybody's getting it, you start thinking, they're harassing us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key thing. That's what they're trying to do, is get you to start to think of yourselves as a group.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the military, you have to function as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has to be coordinated and dedicated to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is why the Romans were able to hold off the barbarians for as long as they could.
Mm-hmm.
The Romans were very unit-organized, functioned and coordinated together, whereas barbarians generally fought sort of in a big mob, but still each man by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And the Romans were able to defeat overwhelming numbers of barbarians for 300 years before before a lot of political things happened in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you've got to get these people to start thinking as a group and depending on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst thing that could happen to you, and likely never happened to me, is for somebody to mess up and the whole unit, the whole platoon, gets punished.
Mm-hmm.
Because then the DIs don't have to discipline you. Then
right.
your buddies discipline you.
Right.
I realized afterwards that that was the reason for this seemingly ridiculous and needless harassment.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they had to get your attention because they had to get you trained in that eight-week period. Those DIs knew where most of us were going. In fact, most of our DIs and instructors in all the training that I had were Vietnam veterans.
How much did they talk to you about their experiences?
Constantly.
Really?
they constantly reminded, where you're going, you're going to have to be alert and you're going to have to work together or you're going to die or be horribly maimed.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them were disabled, especially during my infantry training,
mm-hmm.
Which followed basic training. After I finished basic training, I was promoted from the lowest grade E1 to E2,
mm-hmm.
And then I was sent down to Fort Gordon, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
which was the parachute infantry training center.
Mm-hmm.
And there the discipline was a little bit more relaxed, but all the instructors were Vietnam veterans, and they just constantly beat it into us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the vast majority of you are going to Vietnam right now, and the rest of you are going to Vietnam a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had the stories to tell. And that really got our attention.
What would they tell you about Vietnam?
They'd tell you just about how easy it is to get killed if you didn't do this right, or you didn't, you know, if you didn't do it when you should do it.
Mm-hmm.
They related a lot of personal incidents, especially the gorier incidents.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, a lot of them were disabled, and they just plain thought you better listen. Because your life or the life of your buddy is going to depend upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew, especially as we were going to be parachute infantry,
mm-hmm.
there was The 173rd Airborne Brigade was in Vietnam. The 1st Brigade, the 101st Airborne, was in Vietnam. And at the time, I believe 1st Brigade of the 1st Cavalry Division was airborne.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a heavy need for parachute infantry in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us knew we were going. So we listened.
When you got there, looking back at what they told you, did you find it helpful, valuable, accurate?
The instructors that I had in all my instruction, three different courses of instruction,
mm-hmm.
were all excellent.
Okay.
One or two were jerks, but generally they were all excellent instructors.
Okay.
There were a few things that they didn't instruct us in that I felt they should have,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking back afterwards. But again, they were trying to get as many men trained as quickly as possible because of the demands for manpower
mm-hmm.
in the war were increasing daily. We hadn't even reached the high point of the number of men we had there.
Right.
But they did their best.
What did they tell? What did they? When you said when you got there, you found out some things that you wish they would have told you or taught you or you might have changed. What were those things?
I felt they should have put more accent on combat assault.
Okay.
There should have been a little bit more accent on marksmanship with an M16. We had it, but there should have been a lot more firing, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But especially combat assaults, and that's where you assault in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And different types of objectives, you assault in different ways. I mean, we went through the steps once or twice, but we should have gone through it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, I'll talk about what they should have done in Vietnam in a similar way.
Okay.
But those two items right there especially, I believe they should have put a little bit more emphasis on.
Okay.
I made E3,
mm-hmm.
Which is PFC, Private First Class, out of Airborne Infantry,
mm-hmm.
AIT.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to jump school,
mm-hmm.
where you learn parachuting. It's a 3-week course,
mm-hmm.
Though it was 5 weeks for me because I pulled an Achilles tendon after my first week.
Mm-hmm.
I was offered the chance to get out of the service if I wanted to, but there was just no way I was going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on light duty and crutches for 2 weeks, and then got back into the class during the second week of the 3-week training period.
Okay.
And that was interesting. It was fascinating. The idea of jumping out of a perfectly good airplane.
Right.
Though a little intimidating when you looked at the statistics, really not that many men were hurt or killed during training.
Mm-hmm.
Not as many as would be hurt or killed during an actual combat jump.
Mm-hmm.
Because we jumped from 1,250 feet, not taking any fire during training. In combat, you jump from 750 feet, which means that if something goes wrong, you have much less time to do anything about it.
Right.
There was very heavy discipline, extremely heavy discipline, a lot of heavy physical exercise. I never had any problem getting through the physical exercise. I was in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, the discipline was incredibly tough because you've got to pay attention to what they're telling you. You delay, something goes wrong, and you delay 1 or 2 seconds, you can be the first one on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So their discipline and their training was very, very tough. Plus, airborne troops are always expected to go a little bit further than regular troops.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I finally made my 5 training jumps and got my wings. And while I was in my second week there, the 173rd Airborne Brigade made a quote-unquote combat jump in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a real combat jump. Actually, there was a whole company of armor on the ground already, securing the LZ, or the DZ, I'm sorry, for paratroops, it's drop zone. There was a couple rounds of sniper fire, but it was more of a practice jump than it was a real combat jump. At that point, I decided, but we didn't get that information in training. We just said they told them made a combat blast. And I decided right then that I was going to put in. You had your choice at the end of training. You could put down three different units in order, one, two, three, and you might get those three units. And I put down I wanted to go to the 173rd Airborne Brigade. At the end of jump school, indeed, I got orders for the 173rd.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple of questions about your training overall. First, the weapons training. Did you feel it was adequate? And of the weapons you did use and learn how to use, which one did you prefer?
I always preferred an M16, the standard rifle. I used all three in combat. I enjoyed firing a machine gun in training. In combat, it's a little bit different because the machine gun, being such an important weapon, will draw a lot of enemy fire. And the M79 grenade launcher is a fascinating weapon, too. The only problem is the ammunition is very heavy, and it's a single-shot weapon.
Right.
But the pistol, I wasn't... The 45, to me, for my hand size, was big and bulky. And then they trained us in a 3.5-inch rocket launcher, the old bazooka. And we never used them in the Army. The Marine Corps is the only one that used them. So that was kind of a waste of training right there, I thought. And then those grenade training. But they generally trained us in just about every weapon that we generally used. There were a few weapons, special kind of weapons we ran into in Vietnam, especially in the 173rd, weapons that were being tried in combat for the first time. They seemed to use the 173rd to try them out. But I didn't run into that until I was there.
Okay.
But other than that, the weapons training was excellent. As well as they could in the amount of time they had to teach us.
Did you draw on your experience that you already had with handguns and hunting and the things you did in Alaska?
No. Hunting, most men grow up with or hunters, don't exactly hold a rifle or so in the same way that you do in the military. In the military, it is forced upon you. I mean, just to keep the elbow, if you're right-handed, to keep that right elbow up as high as possible. Because what that does is that stabilizes the weapon. Also, you learn to fire in different positions you wouldn't use in hunting.
Right.
And other than a rifle, the other weapons, of course, you wouldn't use in hunting. So the amount of hunting I did and the like, I'd fired weapons before, but I wouldn't say it had a lot of influence on the type of weapons that I was using, mainly in Vietnam. But I had fired weapons before.
Okay. Tell me about your family support during your training. How much were you in contact with them?
I was in contact with them a lot. It was my mother that was affected the most, of course. She was terrified. I didn't realize what I had done to her until I got back from my third tour and realized that she looked like she aged 12 years.
Really?
And then I heard from, other family members. I mean, she was just constantly, seeing things on TV and the like. The times I was wounded, it just really worked on her terribly. And I had to feel a little guilty about that. But at the same time, I knew I had to do what I felt I had to do, and that I knew that all mothers were that way.
Right.
So my stepfather and my real father, they were worried about me, but they were military men, and they realized, they hadn't been combat soldiers like my uncle, who was killed in action. My father in the Second World War was artillery. I mean, he wasn't right up on the very front.
Right.
But they were worried about me. They were proud of me.
Mm-hmm.
But they got a little upset. Both of them got very upset when I told them that I had enlisted for parachute infantry.
Really?
Oh, yes. My stepfather just blew up at the table. My mother didn't say anything, just stared at her plate. My stepfather blew up, and he said, "What the hell did you go off and join the infantry for? There are so many units that you can learn a trade or a profession.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do with infantry training?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, that didn't have a lot of effect upon me because I was looking at different things.
Mm-hmm.
He was looking at it from a much more remote, mature point of view.
Right.
Whereas I was looking at it from the immature
mm-hmm.
point of view,
mm-hmm.
you know. But both my father and I got a letter from my stepfather, my real father, saying the same thing. But both of them accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
And my sisters, both young, they generally told me about, you know, what my mother was going through. And they were worried, but they didn't seem to be overly worried. There were a lot of their friends had brothers and fathers and the like in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandmother, who raised me and was like a mother for those several years,
mm-hmm.
she was extremely worried. My father's side of the family, who, of course, had lost, you know, my aunts and uncles had lost a brother.
Mm-hmm.
They were a little upset, but again, we're proud.
Right.
But lots of letters, lots of support.
Mm-hmm. It seems that you had a penchant for leadership. You made squad leader in basic, and...
To a point. When I actually got into Vietnam, I gained rank to Spec 4, which
mm-hmm.
is the equivalent of a corporal,
mm-hmm.
quickly. And then I had a chance to go before the board to make sergeant for team leader and go beyond.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I wasn't going to make a career out of the service, and I really didn't feel like I wanted the responsibility.
Right.
And I backed off. Later on in life, I spent years and years as a supervisor in various industries,
mm-hmm.
Which I fell into pretty well up until things started to deteriorate for me.
Mm-hmm.
But in Vietnam, I really had no desire to take a leadership role. Periodically, I was a team leader.
Mm-hmm.
If the team leader had been killed or wounded or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then as soon as somebody had come in with that equivalent rank, E5, then I went back just being a rifleman
okay.
or a machine gunner or a grenadier.
Okay.
But I really wasn't attracted to a leadership role. I just wanted to be an average doggy, do my job as well as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I did.
Mm-hmm.
I never received any decorations for bravery or gallantry or valor.
Mm-hmm.
But I always kept throwing myself back into combat. So I was just an average young combat soldier.
Okay. Now, at Fort Benning, you knew after you completed the course you were going to go to Vietnam. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That was... They told us 80% were going to go to Vietnam.
Okay. And you had made it clear that you wanted to go.
Oh, yeah. I had a contract.
Right.
So I knew I was going.
How did you feel, I mean, as that time approached when you would be shipping out?
I was afraid the war would end before I got there.
Hmm.
So.
Did you keep up with what was happening closely in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Once I was in the military and I knew where I was going, you know, as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a lot of time to sit around reading newspapers or watching TV or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever the instructors told us, you know, I paid as close attention as possible.
Mm-hmm. So when you got there, when you were with your other fellow soldiers, did you feel like you were more informed than they were, or were you about average? About the bigger picture, about what was happening.
I had a slightly... larger idea of the bigger picture, having been in different countries, mm-hmm. knowing something about politics, having been in those two revolutions in Turkey, mm-hmm. and having been an army brat, had been always interested in history, especially military history. Mm-hmm. I think I knew a little bit more about the larger picture, and I definitely accepted the difference in the great difference in cultures much easier. Mm-hmm. I understood, you know, the differences in cultures, and was much more tolerant than a lot of men who, for the first time, had seen a different culture, especially a real backwards third world culture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them didn't think much of the Vietnamese, but they weren't understanding that people are still people. Mm-hmm. There are some cultural differences, but the feelings, the average feelings and the like, I'm sure you've had sociology, mm-hmm. And you learn that really people are basically the same. It's just that there are some cultural differences, and a lot of times those same feelings, they're just manifested differently, mm-hmm. you know. There were quite a few guys that did, you know, really accept the Vietnamese and were very interested, mm-hmm. but an awful lot kind of looked down on them. There were shorter people, like I said, and this is a real poor third world country, mm-hmm. And just didn't understand what it's like to live in. Well, the Vietnamese considered it was normal living. For us, I mean, it would have been illegal to live in a house with no electricity, no running water, things like that.
Right.
You know. So, and the Asian culture being so different, mm-hmm. especially from the Western culture. But like I said, some of the guys had very low opinions. I think the average just waited wait and see. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us in combat troops, in the units I was in, except for my third tour, I didn't have a lot of close interaction with the Vietnamese, just on and off. Mm-hmm. On my third tour, I operated primarily outside of a village, mm-hmm. And got to know the villages even more. Mm-hmm. In the 173rd, when you went out in the field, and you just plain didn't come back for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Some people I find had this attitude that, you know, you flew out into combat for the day, and at the end of the day, you flew back to your barracks. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the way it worked at all. You went out 3 or 4 months, and the closest you had for a break was maybe once every 4 weeks. Your company would guard the battalion artillery, which would be set up in a fortified position.
Right.
But a lot of people I find just did not understand how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
I was fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. And then I had to go through, when I first got to the 173rd, I went in through one of the two Army introduction points. There was one in Long Bien, mm-hmm. down near Saigon, and there was one in Cameron Bay. Mm-hmm. The one at Long Bien was known as the 90th Replacement Depot, mm-hmm. or generally known as the 90th Repo Depot.
Mm-hmm.
And, God, I'd say probably the majority of guys came in through there from the Army.
Mm-hmm.
My unit was stationed at Bien Hoa, which was right nearby at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a short ride over there. And then we had to go through like an extra 2-week training period,
mm-hmm.
to try and teach us a little bit more about this particular kind of fighting.
Right.
And it culminated with an actual, in our case, a small combat operation. In my case, it was an ambush, a night ambush, which the ambush right over from us, about 100 yards, the enemy walked into. So there was and the week before us, one of the training squads walked in, met the enemy, and ended up having one of their instructors seriously wounded. so it was a big deal for the instructors. It was a big deal for us because we figured, you know, we'd made up for, you know, what had happened to the previous class.
Right.
But the class always ended up with some sort of small combat mission.
Okay. Let me ask you a question about going back to that cultural adjustment. How important do you think that is in a war, to be able to come into a country and okay, I can adjust because of my past experience or my own intellectual or emotional ability, I can adjust a little quicker than the guy next to me. How important is that in a war zone?
Especially in this particular kind of war,
mm-hmm.
It was our greatest failure, one of our greatest failures.
Mm-hmm.
We should have had an extended, at least 2 weeks minimum, heavy training on Vietnamese culture,
mm-hmm.
some Vietnamese language, Vietnamese history, you know, why the people do the things they do, why they live the way they live, and how actually they're quite similar to us.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember one thing especially that used to turn off a lot of GIs. Vietnamese, a lot of times while they're talking, one will sit behind the other, and while they're talking, they'll be fingering through the other person's hair.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they're looking for lice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lice are a fact of life over there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and a lot of GIs thought, God, they look like monkeys. Well, they just didn't understand that that's part of life over there.
Mm-hmm.
You live with pests like that. They didn't understand, a lot of the history of Vietnam that led up to what was going on at that particular time,
mm-hmm.
you know, the reasons for being there.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't understand, and they didn't have it emphasized tremendously, and it should have been emphasized just so tremendously. Do not piss off any South Vietnamese, because if you do, you're just going to create yourself another enemy.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, if that South Vietnamese sees trouble coming your way, they're just going to go in another direction.
Mm-hmm.
We should have been taught very heavily, you make friends with these people, your life depends on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the course of the war depends upon it. Now, you're dealing with a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds
mm-hmm.
who are rather egotistic at that age.
You were 19, is that right?
I was 18 when I got there. 18. I turned 19 about a month after I got there.
Okay.
but it just should have been pushed so heavily that, you know, the people are different, but they're basically the same people. They have the same emotions. They love their children. The family is everything in that kind of culture,
mm-hmm.
different from ours. They live in poverty. They may think they're living an average life, but don't look down upon them because you've got things better than they do.
Mm-hmm.
They should have explained the cultural differences and some more words. And once in a while, you'd get teenagers that'd be a little pushy, which is common. You know,
right.
In war or out of war.
Right.
And that should have been, the discipline for that should have just been so heavy. I mean, extremely heavy. It wasn't, it didn't happen all the time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I saw a lot of things that, like an abandoned temple that we'd send set up in for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like nobody realized that this is if foreign troops came to your country and set up in an abandoned church.
Mm-hmm.
This temple was the equivalent of a church. It may not be used at the time, but hey, it's still something religious.
Mm-hmm.
And you never should have set up there, you know?
Right.
But we never thought about it in that way.
Did you think about it when you were actually doing these things?
No.
Okay. But in retrospect, you're able to see this.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Well, I know this one time during my third tour, there was an abandoned temple we set up in it, and the priest had been storing some items there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something in the Buddhist culture about a stork crossing the sky on a turtle's back or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple of guys found some stuff like that, and they sent it home. Well, the priest got real upset, went to the company commander and complained. And company commander immediately went to those troops and said, you have your parents send that stuff back, and then explained the religious significance of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff was sent back. But the thing is, those kind of things should have been explained in the first place.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's an abandoned temple, but it's the same as a church in your country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to respect those things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're searching villages, if you're pulling roadblock checks and the like, you be very courteous, especially to the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to gain these people's support. Now, most South Vietnamese, in my experience while I was there, and everything I have studied since then, I'd say approximately 60% did not want the North Vietnamese in there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people talk about fighting the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, there were Viet Cong, but a lot of Viet Cong units, the Viet Cong were led by the North Vietnamese.
Right.
When Viet Cong units ran short of men, North Vietnamese soldiers would fill them out.
Mm-hmm.
After Tet, when especially the Viet Cong were virtually destroyed as a fighting force,
mm-hmm.
they still retained, for political purposes, the name like a Viet Cong regiment or a Viet Cong division,
mm-hmm.
but they'd be like 70 to 80% North Vietnamese and
right.
commanded by North Vietnamese.
Right.
I'd say about 60% of the South Vietnamese definitely did not want the communists in. The communists were extremely brutal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were just very brutal. I'd say about 25% were for a change because they were disgusted with corruption, which is a way of life in the third world. Bakshish, even in this country,
mm-hmm.
it's practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's not practiced as openly, but it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the remainder basically didn't give a damn who won as long as the fighting just stopped.
Right.
Because a lot of times, if you're in a populated area, it's the villages that get caught in the middle
mm-hmm.
or lose their homes. Most of the time, villagers, if they knew an allied unit was nearby and a communist unit pulled into their village, they went out the other side of the village.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, the communists would let them. Once in a while, the communists would not let them. And there were times used them as shields. And sometimes the goal was to have the allies have to attack the village, and you've got to take it back. So that the people would tend to lose their homes and possessions, and hopefully that would alienate them against the allies.
Mm-hmm.
Most Vietnamese saw through that. But still, I think you have to have some kind of resentment, you know, or at the very least, just want the damn war to end and don't care who wins.
How much do you think the average South Vietnamese peasant understood democracy or this idea of being free and voting and free?
Well, their idea of it, they knew the ideals. Having never been in a democracy, I don't think they understood it completely. It's like the Soviet Union. Going from what it was to try and go over to a democracy, if you have people that have never really experienced democracy,
mm-hmm.
and you make that rapid social change,
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult to do. A lot of the old mechanisms and methods will still change. We didn't arrive where we are today over a period of 20 or 30 years.
Right.
It's been over 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, right now, at this particular point, I mean, back at the end of the revolution, I mean, face it, certain occupations were denied to women. They couldn't vote. Fact of the matter is, I wouldn't be able to vote right now
mm-hmm.
because you had to be a property owner back
mm-hmm.
then.
Mm-hmm.
And there were an awful lot of things that we wouldn't see as democracy today, including slavery.
Right.
They had a rough idea of what it was, but I think if you don't gradually go into it, you've never experienced it before,
mm-hmm.
it's very, very hard to make that change, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The change has to come very slowly. I don't really think I can remember, and I watch politics all the time, current world events and the like. I can't remember too many countries that have just plain gone democratic, as we know democracy, from a tyranny that easily or that well or that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's such a rapid change. And it has to come in short bursts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in the United States felt that, you know, it could be changed immediately, but, you know, they weren't thinking.
Right.
That's an ideal. That's not a realistic point of view. But the South Vietnamese had a basic idea of what it was about. There was a lot of corruption, but there had always been corruption. All third world countries, again, you know, have this corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is based on the fact that civil servants aren't paid very much.
Right.
This is how they supplement their income.
Right.
And that rules and laws have to change. But again, it's going to come slowly. And they were just so used to paying bakshish to get something done or get it done quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they had the basic idea. They knew the type of freedoms and the good life that we had,
mm-hmm.
because we'd show them photographs and stuff like that. And they saw that even as soldiers, we had the right to say things to a certain point,
mm-hmm.
what we felt about things. And, you know, they were for it. But I don't think they realized that you just can't make that rapid change over. It has to come slowly.
Right. How much do you think they were aware of why you were there, why the United States military was there in the country?
Oh, they were there. They were very aware of why we were there. There was no doubt about that. As far as American troops, you always hear that American troops said, why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a bunch of bullshit,
mm-hmm.
because we always knew why we were there. Everybody knew why we were there. We were fighting the communists, North Vietnamese especially,
mm-hmm.
to keep them from taking over Laos, South Vietnam, and Cambodia,
mm-hmm.
which they ended up doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the press is the one that really used to push that. American soldiers always wonder, why are we here? We knew why we were there. That's the biggest... It was a very vogue thing to say, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And some GIs picked up on it. Well, why am I here? You know, this ain't my country.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not stopping and thinking that why we were in the Second World War. The United States was not forced into the Second World War. I mean, we voluntarily went into that war. We forced the Germans and the Japanese to attack us, basically,
mm-hmm.
Because we were supporting their enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But it was there for moral reasons.
How much did you understand about what the United States was trying to accomplish there?
Oh, I understood it completely and fully supported it. And, you know, to this day, still feel, like Senator McCain said, the wrong side won. Especially because I did a lot of reading and studying and talking to Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laos about what happened after 1975.
Right.
And in South Vietnam, you heard about a lot about the killing fields of Cambodia,
mm-hmm.
but reporters just kind of didn't pay any attention to what happened to Vietnam and Laos, and of course the communists weren't about to let them in that much,
mm-hmm.
to see the terrible things that happened. I mean, the communists were just, it was bad, it was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't understand why these tens of thousands of people were willing to take the terrible risk of traveling in a small leaky boat down to Malaysia or wherever just to get out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't realize that really the North Vietnamese were just as corrupt as everybody else because they were a third world country too.
Mm-hmm.
They were very brutal. Southerners were prejudiced against. Most of the leadership positions were taken over by North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And the Viet Cong were actually excluded. And a lot of Viet Cong were very, very bitter about that afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Because they suddenly realized that they weren't going to be allowed to have that much of a say in the new government.
Mm-hmm.
That it was basically Well, it was basically like the end of our Civil War. The carpetbaggers came south.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And life got very brutal. It got very more brutal than normal. It got very tough, very difficult. The labor camps that sprung up were rough. So many South Vietnamese soldiers served just years in these labor camps.
Mm-hmm.
South Vietnamese military cemeteries are completely ignored. If they find a body of a South Vietnamese soldier, they just wrap it up, return it to the family, and the family has to pay a charge for them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas any North Vietnamese or Viet Cong soldier is treated like a hero. As I always say, there were no Abraham Lincolns in Hanoi in 1975.
Right.
But the thing is, the average South Vietnamese knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of South Vietnamese were actually North Vietnamese who fled at the end of the French involvement. In fact, it was the United States that took a couple, 200,000-300,000 of them south.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew what they were escaping from. So.
Okay. What was that flight over to Vietnam like? Do you remember that?
Long. I made that flight six times, three over, three back. That was a long, long flight. Don't remember being particularly nervous. Just waiting to see what was going to happen. Kind of surprised. It was five out of the six times were on civilian airliners.
Mm-hmm.
Just waiting to see what was going to happen.
How about the rest of the troops on the plane?
Same attitude.
Yeah.
Nobody was real freaked out or nervous or anything,
mm-hmm.
even those of us who knew we were going into combat.
How would you describe the morale?
Morale, up until just before I left in July 69,
mm-hmm.
and especially, during my first two tours especially, the mission... Generally, we all felt we're there to win.
Mm-hmm.
Once they started announcing pullouts, then morale started to fall. And I didn't see it real clearly until actually I left the third unit I was in to go back to the rear mm-hmm. to process out. And that's when I saw in the rear areas the real extensive drug use, the attitude, I want out of here. The breakdown of military discipline, the racial breakdown, which stunned me,
mm-hmm.
because in combat units, even up to the end, your race didn't make a bit of difference,
mm-hmm.
Because you depended on each other.
Right.
In fact, we had foreigners. We had several foreigners in our units, Australians, Germans, Filipinos, a lot of Canadians. But everybody was the same, and racial bigotry, ethnic bigotry was not tolerated by the troops in general in the field. It just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
When a group of people have a serious external threat, they pull together.
Okay.
But in the rear areas, they did have problems. And when I got back to the rear area, coming off my last tour, I was really, really stunned.
Can you describe what you saw?
Yeah, I saw barracks that were reserved just for blacks.
Mm-hmm.
I saw barracks that blacks had just taken over. That barracks that bigoted whites, especially with the big Confederate flag flying,
mm-hmm.
had taken over. And in either one, a white man don't dare go into the black barracks, and the black man wouldn't dare go into the other barracks. And then there may have been two or three other barracks of guys that, generally white, who didn't want anything to do with anything.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, when the war was winding down and you start feeling you're just fighting a holding action,
mm-hmm.
their morale was slipping because general discipline was starting to slip. I remember going back, and there was a black guy with me that went back. And we got there, and we saw, the black barracks and the white barracks, and this friend of mine, he said, damn, Roy, I guess I have no choice, but I have to go to the black barracks.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a couple black guys sitting out in front of the barracks, and if you were white and you tried to walk in, mm-hmm. you were in big trouble. Mm-hmm. So it showed that the command discipline, the senior officers, were losing their morale because mm-hmm. they weren't maintaining the discipline. Mm-hmm. That never should have happened to begin with.
Right.
Everybody's generally out of uniform a little bit with beads and peace signs and stuff like that. A little bit's okay, but it used to get really carried away in the rear areas.
Mm-hmm.
I was real, real disappointed with it. The extent of drug use in the rear was very widespread. Marijuana never bothered me as a drug. Alcohol is the one that always bothered me.
What do you mean, bothered you?
Alcohol? Alcohol makes people really weird.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you can't depend upon them to do anything. They're virtually incapacitated.
Mm-hmm.
Marijuana is not quite that bad. In the rear areas where I saw for the first time other drugs being used, opium, I didn't see heroin, but I heard about it. And there was a Vietnamese sleeping pill called the Binoctol that people used to do, and then a lot of drunkenness, which has been a bane of armies for, you know, a hell of a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have as much as I saw during that end of my third tour, you know, whereas I didn't see in the others, and I could just sense the whole attitude was, screw it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad that I had finally made the decision that I was going to get out, because I would not have. Well, if I had stayed in, I would have stayed in a combat unit, because I definitely wouldn't want to have been in the rear from 1969 on.
In April 67, when you got there, there was not a lot of drug use or overuse of alcohol?
There was in the rear areas. Combat troops, you see, generally. It was always boasted that every soldier got two beers and two sodas a day. Well, in the rear, that was true. But in the field, you don't give soldiers two cans of beer a day.
Right.
And number one, for logistical reasons, we only got resupplied every 5 days. And you can't supply 10 beers and 10 sodas along with all the food, the ammunition, and everything else. I mean, our packs weighed 70, 80. I swear to God, I've carried a pack one time weighing almost 100 pounds. So what happened was every fifth day, then we'd get two beers and two sodas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes, and I can remember a couple of times, some guys would trade off their two sodas for two more beers, and then might trade off a favorite sea ration or something for another beer.
Right.
And drink a little bit too much. But that was rare, and that was not tolerated at all, because you do some really stupid things when you're drunk.
Mm-hmm.
There was some marijuana use in the field,
mm-hmm.
but it was only in a very, very, very safe situation. Like you're sitting on top of a mountaintop with sheer cliffs, and there's no way anybody can get to you.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys would smoke.
Mm-hmm.
There were always a few who smoked quite often. There's always those few people.
Mm-hmm.
The drinking thing, of course, enlisted men weren't allowed to buy hard alcohol, but once in a while, it might make its way to a fire support base. I never saw it in a combat infantry unit or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol was the one thing that, if that had started to get out of hand, the troops themselves would have rebelled against it, because you're threatening my life when you are not able to function.
Right.
You know, everybody was straight, tired all the time, always hungry. We were given three C-ration meals a day, and that's 15 meals for 5 days. That's a lot of extra weight, considering everything else you had to carry.
Mm-hmm.
So then they, for a while, they cut it down to two meals a day. Well, a bunch of 18-year-olds growing and working, 18, 19, 20-year-olds growing and doing the hardest work they've ever done and probably ever ever did since. That didn't go over real big. So then they started giving a dehydrated meal that was light. And so we were given two C-ration meals, and we called them LERP rations, the dehydrated meals, and those there. And then a lot of times there were certain items that nobody liked, or virtually nobody liked. And we'd put a hole in the can and throw it away.
What were those items?
Oh, ham and lima beans.
I've heard that before.
They're always known as ham and motherfuckers.
Uh-huh.
The fruit cake. It was horrible. The really coveted items were things like fruit cocktail, peaches, pears, and apricots in that order.
Mm-hmm.
The pecan cake rolls, chicken and noodles. We had the same C rations for a long time until they introduced some more. The bread, this bread wasn't bread like you buy in a market here. It was like a little roll, and it was kind of tough and hard. But and then there was a little can of either peanut butter or cheese or jelly.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the top ones. But, you know, I actually saw one time two guys turn their weapons on each other. The only time I ever saw that in a combat unit, and it was an argument over whose turn it was to get the meal that included the fruit cocktail.
Oh,
and I mean, every guy around them jumped on them both immediately.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this was considered an outrage. You don't point a weapon at each other.
Right.
I mean, fruit cocktail's a favorite, but I mean, still. And then the sergeants came. Oh, boy. I don't think those guys ever thought of doing that again. But it just stunned me. I was a couple of positions away, and I heard the commotion, looked over, and saw them pointing rifles at each other. And I just, what the heck? Fighting was very rare in infantry units. Considering a bunch of young males and the like, I saw maybe two, I think, in the field.
Really?
And that's it.
Amongst your own men?
Yeah.
Okay. And was that one of them, what you just described?
Excuse me?
Was that one of the incidents that you just described?
No. That didn't get to any physical contact.
Okay.
Surprisingly, again, that's how generally close-knit we were.
Right.
There were disagreements all the time,
mm-hmm.
but they never went to physical violence, except two times. One time, in fact, it was just one guy who, and I and everybody else who was there at the time, just suddenly turned and attacked another guy, and we never could really figure out why.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what it is the other guy. We were all there. I remember the other guy saying something. I don't remember what it was, but every one of us were totally stunned, you know, and could not figure out why there was something touchy.
Mm-hmm.
The other time was a fight between two other guys, and I forget what it was over, but it was downright fist fight. Didn't last very long because everybody around him jumps in between.
Right.
Nobody likes to see our guys fighting.
Mm-hmm.
We're all supposed to be together here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
what about incidents or discussion of fragging?
I didn't really hear anything about that until, well, after I got back. There are two incidents. One was the higher command had sent a CID person, which is criminal investigations, out to check on possible drug use.
Okay.
And the thing is, the way he came out and the questions he started asking right away, he just stuck out like a sore thumb.
He was supposed to be undercover.
Yeah.
Okay.
A replacement.
Okay.
And because we got replacements all the time. But he just stuck right out like a sore thumb. And right away, some of his first questions, oh, you got any pot? You know. And everybody just kind of ignored him. And on the third day, he came back from a patrol, and somebody put a hand grenade in his little tent hooch. Nobody would combine their ponchos with his. to make a larger one and sleep together. Usually three guys would.
Mm-hmm.
And he found a grenade laying in his tent. Now, the pin was in it and everything. The pin wasn't straightened. It was a message,
mm-hmm.
okay? And the guy was gone that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
The only other time I know of, but this involved an individual who in this country should either be in a penitentiary or a mental hospital for the criminally insane.
Mm-hmm.
He was a little bit unethical over there. He was intimidating towards other soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And he hated our platoon leader at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we all didn't like this platoon leader. Even our company commander didn't like this platoon leader.
Okay.
He was a real jerk. But my squad was, of which this person was in,
mm-hmm.
and the platoon leader was going to come with us. We sent ambushes out every night when the company set up.
Mm-hmm.
Each platoon would send out one ambush. He was going to kill the guy. He was going to go over his position, hit him on the head, plant some pot on him, and drag him out in front of a Claymore mine, drop him on a trip flare, which is a flare that goes off.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a trip wire going across a trail or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's covered by a Claymore mine, which is a, it sits above ground. It's got about a pound of explosives in it, and it's arched. And the convex side faces out, and it's covered with, I don't know, 600 to 900 steel ball bearings.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's going to drop the person on the trip floor, run back in and blow the Claymore. And then say, well, gee, you know, he was wandering around. And look at that. He had pot on him and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was, I mean, he was a little crazy.
Yeah.
He was good to have along in combat. But mm-hmm. other than that, he was kind of a pain in the ass,
mm-hmm.
this EM. Mm-hmm. And so he told the squad that before we went out, a couple hours before we were due to go out.
Mm-hmm.
And after he walked away, we're all sitting there, you know, Jesus, I mean, you know, we can't stand this platoon leader either.
Mm-hmm.
But murder?
Yeah.
And so finally we just drew straws. The guy that got the short straw, we distracted this one guy that was going to do it. And we all agreed beforehand that if this one person who was going to commit this murder ever found out who went to the company commander, we'd all stand together
mm-hmm.
against him.
Mm-hmm.
And so this person, we distracted the other guy, and this person went to the company commander and didn't name names, just told him that somebody was preparing to do this.
Mm-hmm.
The company commander, who had no respect for that platoon leader at all, didn't like him. Immediately called the battalion commander, didn't detail it over the radio, but said he had something urgent to talk to him about it.
Mm-hmm.
Battalion commander flew in, got out of the ship. The company commander told him about it, told him about the general feeling about that officer by most of the men. And I remember being down next to the position when the word came down for this lieutenant to pack his gear and get up to the LZ immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And he had no idea why he was going out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was relieved of command, basically.
Right.
So instead, the platoon sergeant went out with us, and, you know, that was the end of that.
Okay.
But interestingly, I met this lieutenant again. This is on my first tour. I met him again on my third tour. I was in Da Nang coming back from a three-day R&R in country,
mm-hmm.
and there's thousands of guys down at the air terminal waiting for their flights, and I was leaning up against the side of the building on the outside, sitting down, had my head down on my knees, kind of half dozing, and there's all these guys standing around, and all of a sudden I heard this voice that sounded familiar, and I looked up, and there he was standing right in front of me talking to two other officers. And I stood up and I said, you know, Lieutenant, you remember me? And I said, it's me, Roy. And we always knew each other by our last names, generally. And he said, No. And then I said, in the 173rd, you were 2nd platoon leader for a while. And I was one of your men. And then he remembered me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, come to find out, and this is kind of a tragedy, they sent him to be an Arvin advisor.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, they didn't do the South Vietnamese any favors at all.
Mm-hmm.
They should have sent him back to be a stevedore or something.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what happened to him. He didn't want to talk about it too much. So I said, well, you know, glad to meet you. Good luck, sir.
So you told him the actual reason why he was pulled from the field?
No, I didn't.
Okay, you did not.
No. I just let that go.
Okay. When you got there in April 1967, let me ask you about your attitude about the war. Did you think or feel after you'd been there for a while that the war was winnable, that things were going in the right direction, or did you get a sense that things were not as they seemed?
We were winning that war. It was very winnable. It's the politicians that lost the war.
Mm-hmm.
It was very winnable. There were areas when I got there that the communists could call pretty much their own.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went there, some places we just didn't go, tread extremely lightly.
Mm-hmm.
But when I left in 69, there wasn't any place that we wouldn't go.
Okay.
We may have known that we'd meet heavy combat,
mm-hmm.
but we'd go. And same with the South Vietnamese. Their army was starting to improve. You've got to understand the South Vietnamese army wasn't an army with a heritage, wasn't an army that had any experience, that in fact they hardly had any NCOs. They only had officers and enlisted men,
mm-hmm.
NCOs though, the background.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by the time I left, I had operated with some South Vietnamese units that were fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I had operated with some militia units that were typical militia units. You couldn't
mm-hmm.
depend upon them.
Right.
During our revolution, militia units weren't dependent upon either.
Right.
The militia's militia.
Mm-hmm.
But they were getting much better, and we were getting, we had it down pat, and there were areas that, you know, they'd considered, North Communists had considered their own, that we'll go in there anytime we want.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to stay and fight, then we'll fight.
Mm-hmm.
Areas like the Ashau Valley,
mm-hmm.
The Analo Valley, places like War Zone D, C Zone.
Mm-hmm.
There was no place we wouldn't go or hadn't been already.
Mm-hmm.
We would definitely win in the war. Communist casualties were getting so horrible. If we had done the Cambodian incursion earlier, which we should have done,
mm-hmm.
And even a North Vietnamese general lately said that had we gone into Cambodia or done that thing that the South Vietnamese did by themselves into Laos,
mm-hmm.
that would have pretty well ended the war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the communists continued to insist they didn't have troops there, and if American troops went there, you know, we had to fight with one arm tied behind our back as far as the borders went.
Mm-hmm.
We could have done it. There's no doubt we did it quite well in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
In the invasion in Laos, unfortunately, the whole thing was broadcast openly to the North Vietnamese, you know, a month before it happened, and they were
right.
waiting.
Right. You're talking of Lam Song 719.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If an American infantry division had gone in also,
mm-hmm.
that would have made a big difference. The casualties still would have been heavy. South Vietnamese casualties were quite heavy. North Vietnamese casualties were horrendous,
mm-hmm.
because they would sacrifice men much quicker than Allied units would. And I used to get just stunned, get into a fight, and them attack a real fortified position, and see a couple of hundred bodies out there where we lose two or three men killed.
Mm-hmm.
And they continue to do things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So they really couldn't keep that attrition up forever. They did not have an infinite supply of men. And I also remember long about 1973, reports were coming out that they were starting to have problems in the north finding volunteers, mm-hmm. and families were getting a little upset
mm-hmm.
because all these guys were going south and never heard from again or coming back horribly maimed.
Right.
But there was, we were winning the war. There was no doubt in my mind whatsoever. To this day, they were winning the war.
Mm-hmm.
We were winning the war, I mean, I'm sorry.
Right. Where do you think that went? What happened?
Well, what happened is we pulled out. The South Vietnamese Army, by 1973, it started to become a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1974 was much better. And by 1975 was very good, but then we stabbed them in the back.
Mm-hmm.
We betrayed them.
Mm-hmm.
We cut off their fuel. We cut off their ammunition. We cut off their spare parts. And they just plain ran out of bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they ended up losing.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, when we cut off the stuff in 74, they knew then they didn't have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason that the country fell so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
There was only one big fight down near Saigon, a place off Swan Lock,
mm-hmm.
by the 18th Division. And it defeated, it destroyed three enemy divisions before finally it just plain ran out of artillery ammunition and the like. The Mekong Delta was secure when the South Vietnamese surrendered. The Arvin troops in the Mekong Delta, in a way, didn't want to surrender because they had the Delta pretty much under control.
Mm-hmm.
But they realized that, you know, if they didn't, then with no other support coming from any place else in the country,
mm-hmm.
they'd end up losing in the end.
Right.
Because they'd run out of supplies and be outnumbered.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really why the South Vietnamese lost like they did. Given if we had left much more gradually, and if we had left maybe three divisions, like we ended up leaving, you know, a full division, two divisions for a while in Korea after the war,
mm-hmm.
then one division, and now we've still got a brigade there,
mm-hmm.
That would have made all the difference in the world. And if we kept up the supply and the training.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't. We just pulled out so abruptly. They felt, you know, abandoned. The press was always bad-mouthing them.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut off their supplies. They just didn't have a chance. It was pure, brutal betrayal, as bad as it could be. And it betrayed the American soldier because all those guys who died for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
All those men were horribly maimed for nothing. All of the really hard, deprived existence that we went through for so long was all for nothing. And what I'm going through right now was all for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very, very bitter towards our politician and towards the American people who just got the wrong idea and paid attention to the wrong accusations
mm-hmm.
that led up to that.
Did you buy into the domino theory when you went over?
Oh, yeah. And it happened. they were stopped finally by Thailand. And that's because the Thais knew what was coming. The Thais had been involved in heavy combat in that war. A lot of people don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
They had a regiment in South Vietnam, and they had a couple of divisions fighting in Laos for several years. A lot of people don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Because Laos and Thais culturally are very, very close.
Mm-hmm.
But Thailand was ready. Thailand had been building up supplies and the like. They had combat experience. When the South Vietnamese, or when the Vietnamese tried to conduct an incursion into northeastern Thailand, supposedly chasing some Khmer Rouge,
mm-hmm.
The Thais quite decisively defeated them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just heard a beep.
Okay.
Did you?
No, I did not.
My phone may be running out.
Why don't we end it for this morning, and we'll pick back up at another time.
Okay, I'll look for your email.
Okay.